Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're opening a file today that it feels less like history and more like a recovered blueprint for control. This isn't folklore. It's not a ghost story, though it is plenty chilling. What we have here is a cold, forensic examination of a documented systematic vanishing act. It's from the late 19th century.
Case file 1890-RC.
Exactly. What the authorities at the time, well, what they collectively labeled the Red Clown incidents.
And our mission for this deep dive is precisely that. We're moving past the sensationalism of a clown story, and we're treating this as a rigorous investigative exercise.
Right.
We are looking at a stack of incredibly difficult sources. I mean, they're old, fragmented police reports, local journalistic notes.
And some of those notes, they read more like desperate warnings than news.
They really do. And there's a tiny bit of surviving photographic evidence. We're using all of it to reconstruct a supply chain, a behavioral mandate, and a frighteningly efficient causal sequence.
And the stage for all of this, for this whole mechanism, Midwest County Fairs cycling across the circuit in the late 1890s.
The perfect environment for it.
Yeah, it really was. And the core claim, the premise we're investigating here, it's the central, unsettling idea that binds all these fragments together. The first Happy Meal. It wasn't sold.
No.
It was handed out, and children vanished. That's the starting point.
And we have to start by anchoring ourselves in that environment.
Yeah.
The 1890s in America, especially that fair circuit, it was a world of immense disorganized movement.
Total chaos, really?
Completely. You had families that were transient, traveling huge distances from farms or, you know, newly established towns.
Yeah.
And centralized record keeping was, well, it was rudimentary at best.
Often just handwritten school registers.
Exactly. And that lack of infrastructure, this constant decentralized flow of people, it treated the perfect operational cover for what happened. A systematic, repeatable process of erasure that could succeed precisely because tracking individuals was almost impossible.
The sources suggest the real magnitude of the loss. It was only understood way later, retroactively. Once different jurisdictions started comparing notes months after the fact.
Right. They had to piece it together long after he was gone.
Our evidence trail is fragmented, like you said, but it's consistent. It's consistent across every single county touched by that fair circuit that year. So we're going to trace the sequence. We'll start with the arrival of this nameless figure, the specific mechanism he used, that chilling red box, the documented change in the children's behavior, the physical evidence left behind, and then, finally, the enduring, uncomfortable visual echo that somehow survived into the modern era of branding.
Our goal here really is to trace the functional system, not the identity of the operator. That's key. How does a simple object, a small, brightly colored paper box, become the instrument of a broader systemic failure?
Yeah. How does that happen?
It essentially allows the operator to disappear groups of children without leaving any traditional, you know, loud crime scene evidence. We're analyzing the system's terrifying functionality.
It's the silent efficiency of it all. That's what elevates this beyond just a simple crime. So let's start at the beginning of the trail, the arrival and the setup.
Absolutely. The figure at the center of all this was a drifter. He just materialized at county fairs across the Midwest. And a key initial finding right away in the investigation is that he never provided a legitimate name.
He didn't even use an alias.
No, he just avoided identification altogether.
And that, I mean, in investigative terms, that right there is the first intentional layer of operational security, isn't it? He was a phantom from the very beginning.
Precisely. You can see in the notes. The locals, they struggled to even label him. They just defaulted to the most obvious descriptor, the Red Clown.
Just what he looked like.
That's it. This reliance on a functional title, Red Clown, rather than a personal name, it suggests an operational identity. It's a role, not a person. He wasn't trying to build a career or a reputation. He was simply enacting a procedure.
And his appearance, well, it certainly contributed to the unavoidable nature of the event. He wore a dark red suit. And you have to imagine, set against the dust and the canvas of a late 19th century fair, that color would have just stood out so intensely.
It's a beacon.
It is. But the physical detail that is consistently highlighted in almost every fragment of the source material, the one thing that seemed to viscerally disturb observers was that painted grin.
Mm. The smile.
Yeah. It was described repeatedly as being too wide to feel friendly.
Let's focus on that for a second. That smile. The wide, unfriendly grin, it functions as the first layer of psychological control.
How so?
Well, the human brain is hardwired to recognize and respond positively to a smile.
Right.
It signals safety, approachability, reward. But when that gesture is exaggerated, when it becomes too wide, it crosses the threshold into the uncanny valley.
It feels wrong.
It violates the biological expectation. It triggers this immediate cognitive dissonance. You see the shape of a smile, which your brain says is safe or happy, but the execution of it, the sheer scale of it, says wrong or threat.
So you're already off balance before you even get to the 10.
That dissonance is the crucial precursor to manipulation. You are already mentally off kilter, unsure of the emotional register you should be adopting. The operator used his own face as a tool to destabilize his audience before the transaction even began.
And the tent operation itself, it was surprisingly minimal for a traveling fair attraction. The sources described the small tent with a hand-painted sign that simply read, "Happy Meal."
Just those two words.
Just two words, instantly conveying a sense of reward and, like, personalized nourishment. There was no spectacle, no flashing lights.
And that minimal branding is highly strategic, you know? It suggests that the appeal wasn't the showmanship, it was the promised content. The personal reward. This wasn't some crowded ride designed for passive viewing. It was structured as an individualized transaction.
And the lure. Yeah. It was brilliant in its simplicity for that era. Admission was free for children.
Which is crucial.
It is, because it eliminated the biggest barrier to volume, the need for parental financial involvement.
Maximum exposure, maximum foot traffic. In a high traffic environment like a county fair, where parents are often distracted or busy, removing that financial barrier means the population is self-selecting for the system.
You're just getting a constant stream of kids.
And you need that volume. It's absolutely necessary for a systemic operation to succeed without raising localized suspicion after only a few children vanish.
Mm-hmm.
You have to cast a wide net at first.
So once they're inside, the atmosphere was carefully managed. This is where the sensory data from the investigative notes gets really compelling. The light was dim.
Mm-hmm. It reduces visual reference points, forces focus inward onto the transaction.
And the air smelled highly specific, like sweetbread and varnish.
This is critical evidence of intentional design. Let's analyze that combination for a moment. Sweetbread is universally comforting. It's associated with home, safety, immediate reward. It lowers your psychological defenses instantly.
But the varnish.
But the varnish smell. That is industrial, chemical, sharp. In the 1890s, that's the smell of manufacturing, of fresh paint on wood, or treated canvas.
It's the manufactured scent of procedure laid right over the natural scent of comfort.
Exactly. The environment is engineered. Comfort is used as the lure. But that industrial undertone establishes that this is a controlled space. It's a kind of psychological factory floor disguised as a bakery.
So the child's brain is getting these contradictory mixed signals. Safety, but also procedure.
Required procedure. This manufactured environment sets the stage perfectly for control and manipulation. It's moving far, far beyond innocent entertainment.
You raised a crucial point earlier about his anonymity. If the operation required massive logistics, I mean, hauling crates of materials across multiple state lines, how did this lone drifter manage it all without drawing a lot of attention or needing any visible cash flow? Who was funding this?
That is the central financial mystery, and it ties directly into what they find later in the wagon. The lack of a clear financial motive, the lack of any cash intake, it means that the operation was pre-funded.
So someone else was backing him.
Likely by an outside source or organization we'll never know about. It makes the Red Clown essentially an operational conduit. He didn't need to generate profit. His objective was the successful execution of the mandate.
He was paid in supplies and transit.
Yes. His intent was collection, not commerce. And that makes the investigation exponentially harder and far more sinister.
So the focus wasn't the man, it was the process. And that process centered entirely around one artifact, the object handed to every single child. This is where the mechanism of control becomes physical.
This red box is the delivery device. It's the delivery device for the operational mandate. It is the single most important piece of evidence in the entire Red Clown system.
It was a small red paper box. And it featured a yellow emblem. Simple, yes, but incredibly strategic in its design.
Oh, the visual design is paramount. Red and yellow are high-impact, high-visibility colors. They demand attention. They are the colors of energy, reward, immediate recognition. Even to a child who wasn't used to constant corporate advertising.
They just pop.
They do. This specific, repeated combination of color and shape creates a powerful, instant, recognizable brand identity. That red box was the singular visual promise.
And the contents, detailed so meticulously in the surviving police notes, they show a really functional design. So, item number one, a soft bun.
Easy to eat, simple carbohydrate.
Item number two, a slice of cold meat. A protein source. Meant to be filling to ensure a short-term sense of physical satisfaction, completion.
Right.
And item number three, a hand-carved wooden toy. The ephemeral prize, you know, the distraction, the element of perceived fun.
Those three items ensure compliance through basic physical needs and reward. But the true engine of the control system was the fourth item, the seemingly innocuous one.
The tiny card. With one simple rule. This is where the transaction moves from being a gift to being a contract.
The rule card is the psychological linchpin. It wasn't just a treat. It was a required procedure. The rule itself was explicit, yet so simple, demanding immediate comprehension. Finish the food and come back tomorrow.
Finish the food, return the next day. A two-step mandate. It required continuous participation.
And this establishes a system of mandatory return and completion. The gift is immediately transformed into a debt, a task. The food must be completed, that's the first test of obedience, and the return trip is the second, guaranteeing the repetition of the process.
So if a child fails that first step, they might not return, which disrupts the system's efficiency.
Exactly. It ensures self-selecting participation without the operator having to actively re-lure new children every 24 hours. Once the child accepted that box, they implicitly accepted the rule and the accompanying mandate for obedience.
It's a perfect example of what we've called the Monopoly Index Entry Principle before.
It is. The game trains you before it pays you. The initial free box and meal, that's the game being introduced. The rule card is the mandatory training period. It requires compliance, and it teaches the child to follow instructions associated with that red box.
And the payment.
The subsequent day's transaction, the whole reason for the mandated return, that's the payment. Or, well, it's the next stage of the system. It reinforces the loop until the children are fully integrated into the system's mandate.
It's just chilling how early in the history of consumerism someone mastered this level of behavioral conditioning, all with a simple, branded paper container. The red box wasn't just a container, was it? It was a psychological tool engineered for a captive, young audience.
And that focus on efficiency and instant recognition, red, yellow, box, rule, it allowed the system to operate at scale. See the colors. Remember the satisfying taste. Remember the rule, its efficiency at its most unsettling.
So the children enter, they receive the box, and they leave. And this is where the external observers start to document the profound shift that signaled the operation was working. Which brings us to section three, the immediate aftermath and the behavioral shift.
This section relies entirely on external eyewitness accounts, which means it's based on observable, non-physical evidence of the mechanism actually working.
Our sources describe the reaction of those external observers with a specific visceral phrase. One of them says, the first, OS, was the kids afterward.
That's a direct quote.
It is. And that suggests that the initial transaction was accepted, right? It was free, it involved a toy, but the result was immediately and profoundly alarming.
Well, if the red clown had been running a standard entertainment tent, the children should have exited with chatter, energy, excitement. They should have been demanding to go on another ride.
But that's the complete opposite of what was documented.
Antithetical, yes.
The source material consistently notes this critical change. The children did not run out laughing or excitedly showing off their toys. They walked out, quiet, pale, and obedient.
Quiet, pale, and obedient. In the 1890s, especially at a bustling fair, children exhibiting that level of uniform, immediate suppression of personality. It would have been instantly noticeable.
Oh, absolutely.
The paleness suggests a type of shock, maybe fatigue, or perhaps even a metabolic effect from the specific food preparation. We don't know. But the quietness and the obedience, those are the clear products of the psychological mandate.
It suggests the rule card's power wasn't just about the words on it, it was about the psychological state it required. They exited already focused on the mandate.
Absolutely. One source offered that specific chilling analogy to describe their demeanor. It noted they looked like someone had turned their volume down.
Wow.
Their physical function remained, but their innate spark, their autonomy, It seemed to have been suppressed, placed into a holding pattern of compliance.
Let's talk about the social context there. Even in the 1890s, which was generally an era of stricter child rearing than today, this uniform obedience must have been deeply unsettling to parents and observers.
It violates the social contract of the fair. A fair is supposed to be chaos, noise.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Excitement. It's a temporary suspension of strict discipline.
Right, it's a treat.
It is. So for a large group of children to exit an attraction in uniform, quiet compliance, it breaks the expected pattern. It signals that an outside force has overridden the child's natural state.
Yeah.
The system of obedience was asserting itself immediately upon acceptance of the box.
So parents' initial unease about this strange, wide, grinning clown, it only turned to real panic after the pattern surfaced. After it proved the incident wasn't just localized to one child or one day, but it was a calculated, repeatable process that worked on every child who entered.
The consistency is the key proof of calculated design. Had the behavior been inconsistent, you know, some happy, some upset, some noisy, authorities would have just dismissed it as typical fairground variability. But the systemic, repeatable quietness and paleness across multiple children in multiple towns, that proves the mechanism itself was reliable.
The stage is now set for Section 4, repetition and erasure. The red clone had the mechanism, he had the necessary control over the children's behavior. The next step was the systematic disappearance.
The true horror of this file is hidden in that systematic repetition. The operational speed of the red clown was essential to his success.
That's right. The sources emphasize the systematic movement of the operation. Town after town, the tent arrived. Same minimal sign, same unsettling figure. Kids lined up, drawn by the visual cues and, you know, the successful behavioral training from the previous day's returnees.
The loop was active.
The cycle of the red box and the rule card just repeated seamlessly across the entire Midwest circuit.
And that movement was his primary defense against local investigation. If the red clown had stayed in one place, the disappearances would have been immediate and overwhelming to local authorities.
They would have caught on right away.
Immediately. By leveraging the transient nature of the fair circuit, he decentralized the evidence trail. He ensured that no single jurisdiction had the full picture until months later.
And the resulting loss. It became evident not through police reports of struggle, but through the dull, quiet, administrative process of bureaucracy. The primary consequence detailed in our sources is chillingly consistent. By the end of the fair's run in each town he visited, names started disappearing from school rolls.
And this is the core evidence. This is where you see the magnitude of the problem. It illustrates a crucial investigative lesson. The absence of records becomes the evidence of the crime.
The empty space.
The empty space. When school registers thin out abruptly in a distinct sequential pattern across multiple counties, the erasure itself becomes the primary artifact of the incident. There's no physical body to find, no visible struggle, just an empty space in a ledger book.
It's the silent evidence of absence.
Exactly. And we need to be clear why this pattern of loss is so telling. We use the investigative framework from the Richter case file, remember? Like Klaus Richter, erasure becomes the evidence. The focus shifts entirely from tracking the victim to tracking the hole they left behind in societal records. The system was so efficient that the only lasting trace was the missing names.
And the disappearance isn't random. It's directly linked to that operational mandate.
It has to be.
The obedience we saw in Section 3 and that rule to come back tomorrow, they form the direct causal chain leading to the final consequence of vanishing names. They complied, they came back, and then they were gone.
The system used the pre-existing system of societal tracking, the school system, to highlight its own devastating effectiveness. The children returned as mandated, but where they went on that subsequent day or what the payment for their training was, that's where the records stopped cold.
It reminds me of the real Wendy case file, that idea that records can freeze while lives keep moving.
It's the same principle. The official documented life of that child stops the moment their name is marked absent indefinitely from the school register.
And this reliance on voluntary trained compliance, all secure through a small red box, it meant the red clown eliminated the need for force or any kind of loud struggle. The silence of the children's exit led directly to the silence on the school rolls. It just speaks to a terrifying calculated efficiency.
It does. It shows that the red clown didn't need complicated weaponry. He needed advanced psychology, a perfectly repeatable mandate, and the operational mobility afforded by the fair circuit.
By the time law enforcement across several counties finally connected the pattern, the red clown was already long gone, on to the next jurisdiction. But they did manage one critical intervention. And this leads us to Section 5, the physical evidence, specifically the wagon search.
Yes. This is the investigative climax, where the true intent and the scale of the operation are finally revealed through inventory. They managed to isolate and search the drifter's wagon.
Okay, so first, let's detail the strategic absence. What was not found tells us just as much as what was. The sources confirmed there was no leftover food.
Meaning the supplies were always completely consumed, satisfying the first part of the rule. Perfect efficiency.
No hand-carved wooden toys. This suggests they were either successfully taken by the children or they were perfectly disposed of, town by town, leaving no trace. And, critically, no cash.
Which again reinforces that this was not a profit venture in the traditional sense. It was a system of acquisition or collection funded for its specific purpose.
The absence of traditional criminal evidence is itself proof of extreme preparation. If this was a botched operation, they would have found spoiled food, discarded toys.
Exactly. And the lack of financial motive also means we can eliminate theft or robbery from the profile. The goal was the untraceable execution of the operational cycle.
But the disturbing presence, what was found, that's what reveals the systematic, bulk, industrial nature of the Red Clown's supply chain. Inside the wagon, they found crates of red paint.
That phrase is plural.
Crates of yellow cloth and stacks of unused boxes, all identical, suggesting they had been manufactured far away from the fair circuit in immense bulk.
This inventory analysis is devastating. The presence of unused boxes, bulk paint, and cloth suggests preparation for future operations, potentially dozens or even hundreds of them.
This wasn't a short-term thing.
This was not a short-term, opportunistic crime committed by a lone sociopath. This was a well-funded, industrialized endeavor disguised as a traveling show. The drifter was essentially just carrying the raw, non-consumable materials required to perpetuate the system.
So the food and the toys, they were just temporary consumables. The paint, the cloth, and the boxes. Those were the true supplies, the permanent tools of the system. The wagon was, functionally, a mobile factory for controlled disappearance.
And the sheer scale implied by crates of paint and cloth, that goes far beyond what one man could reasonably manufacture on the road.
It proves outside organization.
It has to. Even if the investigation never successfully identified that organization, the operator's role was assembly and deployment. That's it.
And then we come to the single surviving piece of transactional evidence, an artifact that was small enough, maybe damaged enough, to escape disposal. A little rule card. It was later photographed and documented in a county evidence file.
This card is the ghost of the mandate. It represents the only physical link to the control mechanism that was ever recovered.
The sources mentioned the writing was heavily smudged, probably handled by dozens of children, or maybe damaged during the frenzy of the investigation. But forensic efforts, the best they had in the late 1890s, they managed to decipher the final critical line on that fragile paper artifact.
And the last readable line on that smudged card was, "Come back tomorrow."
It's so powerful, isn't it? It's the final piece of proof. It confirms that the operational mandate was purely about the loop, about repetition. The system wasn't about the meal itself, it was about the required action.
And that simple three-word phrase contains the entire chilling structure of the Red Clown's success. It encapsulates the required obedience and the promise of repetition that secured the ultimate erasure. It reminds me of the Buzz Lightyear index entry.
How so?
Artifacts outlived their makers. The clown vanished. The operation ceased. But the rule card, the blueprint for compliance, it survived in an evidence file.
And after the wagon search, what happened to the operator?
The final, anticlimactic piece of the case file just confirms the drifter's functional identity as a phantom. The red clown was gone.
Just vanished.
Vanished as quickly and as untraceably as the children he lured. The only things left were the instructions and the packaging materials, waiting for a next deployment that, thankfully, never occurred. The system successfully erased both the victims and the operator simultaneously.
The disappearance of the operator validates the efficiency of the entire system, doesn't it? The goal was achieved and the investigative trail was cut clean. But the story, the aesthetic, the visual echo of it all, it didn't vanish with him.
No.
It lingered quietly in the cultural memory of the Fair Circuit. And this brings us to our final section, section 6, Legacy and the Modern Echo.
This is, for me, the most profound connection in the entire deep dive, how a successful mechanism of systematic erasure can be aesthetically recycled and commercialized decades later.
We have to fast forward the timeline. The Red Clown incident ends, the figure vanishes, the children are gone, but the artifacts, that specific combination of colors, the red box design, and yes, that unsettling smile, they linger in the cultural ether, maybe through local legends, maybe through surviving fair pamphlets.
Or, as the sources indicate, a specific surviving fair poster.
Right. And that aesthetic memory resurfaced years later in Chicago, a city becoming a hub for, you know, burgeoning national commerce. And there was a growing restaurant chain looking for a memorable, instantly recognizable mascot and brand identity, one aimed at children and families. Wow. The sources detail the specific event that brought the system's aesthetic back from the dead. An advertising firm tasked with branding this growing restaurant chain, they acquired an old fair poster. They were looking for something familiar, visually powerful, something that spoke to the sense of fun and reward that the turn of the century fairs represented.
And this is where we have to analyze the adoption process, mm-hmm. that advertising firm. Whether they were consciously aware of the traumatic source material or simply drawn to the deep psychological resonance of the visual mnemonics.
We'll never know for sure.
We won't. But they recognized the established effectiveness of the design. They sought out cultural familiarity and visual power, and the Red Clown's aesthetic offered both, honed through years of successful, silent operation on the fair circuit.
And what they chose to copy is what makes the connection so undeniable and so unnerving. They didn't copy the whole story, but they copied the successful visual mechanism, the components that guaranteed a child's attention and instilled a sense of reward. Explicitly, they took three core elements. Number one, the colors.
The high impact red and yellow.
Number two, the box. The small red paper box designed specifically to present a personalized reward to a child.
The physical object of the mandate.
And number three, the smile.
The smile. That wide, unnatural, too wide to feel friendly grin of the original Red Clown. This is the crucial chilling signature of the operator that they chose to integrate into their new brand identity.
And the critical point here is the profound omission. The ad firm took the successful aesthetic mechanism, the visual lure, the promise of a controlled reward, but they severed it from the terrifying historical consequence of mass erasure. They adopted the packaging, the colors, and the face of the traumatic history. They effectively commercialized the visual success of a mechanism designed for behavioral control.
Just think about the power of that design. Red and yellow guarantee attention. The box provides the tangible reward, and the smile provides the human yet slightly unsettling signature of the promise. The system of control lives on entirely through its visual cues, proving the power of the original design was independent of the operator or the outcome.
The colors in the box, they represent efficient mechanics. The smile, though, that's the signature of the operator, the controller. By incorporating that specific, unsettling grin into a modern brand aimed at children, the system of control gained a kind of immortality through visual culture.
It's a terrifying thought.
It's the idea that the most successful, persuasive systems are the ones whose aesthetics we willingly participate in, often without recognizing the source of the appeal.
It's the ultimate survival story for a horrific operational design. The Red Clown's success was in creating an image so powerfully associative with reward and child surprise that it became cultural shorthand. It survived the actual historical horror and was resurrected for global commerce.
And that's the sting, isn't it? We're looking at a corporate visual identity that, by the pure mechanics of successful design selection, reflects the face of a systematic eraser. The system survived not in some hidden vault, but in plain sight, on every subsequent box handed out across the decades.
So, to synthesize, we've examined how a sequence of small, repeated steps, free admission, specific contents, a simple rule led to systematic quiet erasure in the 1890s. The horror was in the cold, efficient functionality of the system, surviving only through the evidence of packaging materials and that one rule card.
We've traced how a specific combination of color, shape, and mandate created an unforgettable and horrifying brand in the late 19th century. The Red Clown used the aesthetics of reward to train obedience, ensuring that the vanishing was silent and systematic.
And that aesthetic was so potent, so deeply effective, that a century later, a highly sophisticated commercial entity chose to replicate it almost entirely, drawing on that deep, successful, and entirely submerged cultural memory.
Which leaves us with the final chilling thought that builds on the source material we forensically examined today. If the box and the colors were copied decades later to sell food using that memory, then the smile that was copied, the wide grin of the nameless Red Clown, what exactly was that smile meant to signify? Was it a promise of pleasure? Or was it the sign of utter successful control over the subject?
And when we willingly engage with that highly familiar visual today, are we simply acknowledging a successful commercial history? Or are we, through repeated purchase and engagement, subconsciously complying with the final indelible historical rule to come back tomorrow?
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.